there's a tendency in the Midwest to pronounce things as we choose to.
That's Brent Jackson. He's a writer, an artist, and a proud lifelong Kansan.
So, for example, in Missouri, there is not Versailles, Missouri, but Versailles, Missouri. And in Kansas, instead of being El Dorado, there is El Dorado, Kansas.
His fixation on our special way of pronouncing town names inspired him to rewrite a poem by Edgar Allan Poe. The poem is originally called El Dorado, but Brent's version is El Dorado. And we're going to start our Kansas Day show here on KCUR's Central Standard with that poem.
A rural youth with one dead tooth got lost up near Mankato. So he went long while singing a song. He looked for El Dorado. Then he grew old, the truth be told. His heart, it dried like Play-Doh. He traveled far in his cousin's car, looking for El Dorado. As he weakened, he met a deacon, chewing an heirloom tomato. Oh, tell me, please, I've lost my keys. How far to El Dorado? It's miles from here, out past next year. Say, can you see that tornado? Hurry, feller, I've got a cellar too far to El Dorado.
That was Brent Jackson reading his homage to the town of El Dorado, Kansas. From El Dorado, if you drive about 160 miles, you'll be in the next stop on our Kansas Day special, Johnson County. Let's revisit a conversation about the history of that county. It was inspired by a simple question. Who was Johnson? Let's give it a listen.
The Shawnee Indian Mission, as it stands today, is a landmark to a complicated time in America's history.
We're inside the Shawnee Indian Mission State Historic Site, tucked away in the residential Fairway neighborhood. The building that houses the museum was built in 1839. This building has been a lot of things over the years. It's where Shawnee and other American Indian children attended boarding school. It was also the estate of Reverend Thomas Johnson, a controversial political figure who Johnson County would later be named for. And in the 1900s, the building was even a brothel.
This room was the chapel. The room upstairs was divided into class areas. The boys' dorm was on the third floor of this building.
John Forbes is a longtime volunteer at the museum. He says it amazes him how many people pass by or live right by this site and have no idea about the history. Not just of the site, but of this county.
Let's stop and let's take a look, because there's a ton of history here. I have to be careful or I give you start getting into a 50-minute discussion of things that...
Well, you are in luck, because that discussion is exactly what we are going to have right now. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's show is an exploration of the history of Johnson County, starting with Reverend Thomas Johnson and the Shawnee Indian Mission. We've got three historians joining us today. Stephen Warren, professor of American Indian Histories and Cultures at the University of Iowa. Good morning.
Good morning.
And John Bowes joins us from the History Department at Eastern Kentucky University. He's the author of Exiles and Pioneers, Eastern Indians in the Trans-Mississippi West. Hello, John.
Good morning.
And here in the studio, I'm joined by Howard Ziegenhorn. Howard, tell us the story of how you became involved in the Shawnee Indian Mission.
Gina, my wife and I moved right next door to the mission in the year 2000. And we have a gate that leads right directly into the mission. So it was impossible not to become involved in the mission.
So what interests you about the history of this place at this juncture in time, historically, as the West is being settled and the United States, as we know, it is still fairly new?
It is a sad thing to say, but controversy makes interesting history. And you had mentioned that Reverend Johnson was controversial, and he was, and therefore the mission was. The history is what I'm interested in.
Tell us more about that.
The mission was founded in 1830 over near Turner, Kansas. In 1839, in search of a better place with more water and timber and prairie land, it was moved to its present location in Fairway. At the time they moved, or when they moved, they had 2,240 acres. And those acres had good water supply, timber nearby, prairie. Within the first year, they had 500 acres under cultivation and divided into 100-acre facilities.
What do you know about Reverend Thomas Johnson, who gave Johnson County its name?
He was a person that was a large man physically, 270 or 80 pounds, but not a fat man. He was a person who was a slaveholder, which isn't too well known. He is a person who had many friends and many foes, probably because he did become a wealthy person during the 23 years in Fairway and 33 years total. And success sometimes
brings... A wealthy person and a slaveholder, right?
Yes, he was. And he had a good relationship, and his whole family had a good relationship with their slaves. Speaking of his family, there were 13 children, 7 lived to adulthood, and they were very close to Uncle Jack and Aunt Charlotte, two of the longtime slaves. Of course, they would not have called them slaves. Probably Reverend...
The Johnsons would not have referred to these people that way?
No, because they thought they were part of the family.
Well, more about that later, but how did Reverend Thomas Johnson and his family end up in Kansas?
He was born in Shenandoah Valley, and they moved when he was a young man to Fayette, Missouri, in Howard County, which is central Missouri. From that point on, he migrated to Kansas when he was appointed as a missionary by the Methodist Missionary Society.
John Bowes, with us from Eastern Kentucky University. What do you know about that?
Well, what you have with Thomas Johnson, with the mission, you have a situation which, you know, as Howard ably mentioned, was part of a larger effort of missionaries, but also a larger part of American expansion. I mean, Thomas Johnson is an imposing figure in early Kansas history, in part because of his participation with the mission, but also because of his involvement with early regional politics, and especially as it relates to the struggle and battles over whether or not Kansas would be a slave state or a free state.
What was his involvement in that?
Well, what you have, as Howard mentioned, he was a slave owner, and you know, we have records of Thomas purchasing slaves up into 1856. I would respectfully disagree with the notion that he necessarily would not have called them slaves, as he was certainly someone who was an advocate for making Kansas a slave state. He was willing to have the individuals who were part of trying to make Kansas a pro-slave state, a state where slave would be allowed in 1855, 1856. They were at the mission.
And no no discomfort with the terminology slave, to the best of your knowledge?
Certainly not. I mean, you have a man who was born in Virginia. He lived his life in states where slavery was legal, and he had slaves in Kansas Territory, which at the time, you know, according to the Missouri Compromise, slavery would not be allowed. I mean, it was something that others protested, and even various Indian tribal members protested. The presence of slaves in a territory that they knew, according to the Missouri Compromise, should be free.
And Thomas Johnson founds the Shawnee Indian Mission. How does his relationship with this particular group of Indians emerge? How does that develop?
What you have, as Indian removal takes place and as you begin to have the relocation of tribes west of the Mississippi River, and specifically west of the Missouri border, you have a lot of different missionary institutions who are very engaged in trying to establish relationships with tribes so that they can set up missions. You had to gain the consent of a particular tribe and their leadership to establish a mission in their territory. And one of the fascinating things, you know, in the early 1830s, as the Shawnees are relocated or removed to eastern Kansas, is the battles among different denominations to establish missions. So, you know, Thomas Johnson and the Methodists were only one of many competitors seeking to establish a mission among the Shawnees.
Well, let's turn to Stephen Warren for more perspective on the mission Johnson ran. Stephen joins us from the University of Iowa, and he's also the author of The Shawnees and Their Neighbors, 1795 to 1870. Hi, Stephen.
Hi.
What do we need to understand about the history of the Shawnee Indians in our region to understand this mission and its significance? Kind of bring us up to the point where this mission's created. Where does their story begin?
Well, sure. I guess I'd like to follow up on Howard and John's comments by just saying that there's a trajectory to the reservations in Kansas that leads us all the way back to the eastern seaboard. And Thomas Johnson's story with the Shawnees actually begins in Kentucky. He married a woman named Sarah Davis, who was a cousin to a famous Shawnee captive named Stephen Riddell, who was actually, when he was a captive, kin to Tenskwatawa and Tecumseh. You know, Sarah Davis would have been raised on stories relating to the Shawnee. And then when Johnson was in Missouri, he actually lived near a group of people in a village known as Rogerstown, which was actually led by a Shawnee chief and former captive, a guy named Lewis Rogers. And he also lived among Daniel Morgan Boone, who was a good friend of his partner at the mission, a guy named Alexander McAllister. And so the point of all this is just to say that oftentimes missionaries had pretty deep and extensive relations with the tribes they worked with. And so what I find fascinating about the whole story is that these folks you know, were involved in the displacement of Native Americans in places like Kentucky and then went on to become missionaries to them in places like Indian Territory or Kansas. And so there's a lot of transformation going on, but they're very much interconnected and interrelated people.
What do we know about the history of the Shawnee Indians before they ever arrived in Kansas?
The Shawnees were known as the greatest travelers in America.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they were very confusing and still are to historians and anthropologists because when they become known to colonizers, there are Shawnee people that are more than 1,000 miles apart from each other at simultaneous places from Illinois to South Carolina to Maryland, and so what we see in Shawnee history is a vast diaspora out of the Ohio Valley in response to colonization, and then the United States government attempts to consolidate all of those different Shawnee villages in what is now Kansas, and so
on a reservation.
On the shared reservation, this 1.6 million acre reservation.
Where in Kansas was this located?
Johnson County, and it stretched almost to Topeka, Kansas. And so, you know, this is a pretty vast social experiment in trying to create a national government out of all of these villages that for hundreds of years have developed different histories as they've moved across what is now the United States.
So these are actually separate peoples on some level who are being thrust together as part of political decisions that are happening.
Yeah, that's correct. And so they share a common culture and a common language, but they are by no means a common polity or or a political unit. And so you can imagine how the competing missionary organizations, from Methodists and Baptists to Quakers, enter into the equation with these different villages that are now consolidated on the reservation. And when I look at Shawnee Mission, what I see is a mission that was triumphant in the tug of war between these competing villages by becoming kind of the center of power on the reservation.
I want to just establish a couple of other things. There are some events that take place that also, as I understand it, really shaped the migratory patterns and just cultural development of the Shawnee Indians, things like the Trail of Tears and the Indian Removal Act. Can you talk to us about those?
Yeah, and certainly my colleague John should as well, but it's important to remind viewers that in response to the Indian Removal Act of 1830, Shawnees were removed from various villages in Ohio, as well as Missouri and Arkansas, and consolidated in what is now Kansas. But that reservation in Kansas was very ephemeral or short-lived, so that there's actually a second removal that takes place in the aftermath of the Civil War. And so now there are three federally recognized Shawnee tribes in what is now Oklahoma. And so they actually endure two Indian removals. And, you know, one of the things that's fascinating about Kansas and the Johnson County area is that if you look at the Shawnee Reservation, they are surrounded by Native tribes, including the Miami and the Delaware, and many others, whose original homeland is Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois. And so Kansas became a kind of a repository for federally recognized tribes that were originally from the Old Northwest or the Ohio Valley.
John Bowes, jump in on this. What do you have to add to that?
Well, what I'd like to say is, especially in relation to the Indian Removal Act, one of the things is we generally see that and label the act that was passed in May of 1830. We see that as kind of the epitome of encompassing Indian removal. We see the involvement of Andrew Jackson and the Trail of Tears and the Cherokee Nation. And I think one of the things that the Shawnee experience in particular illustrates in building on what Steve was just talking about is the fact that by 1830, at the time that the Indian Removal Act is passed, most of the Shawnees are already living west of the Mississippi River, that you do have several villages of Shawnees in Ohio that are removed after 1830. In relation to pressure on their land. But you had also seen, as a result of the violence of the American Revolution, the violence especially in the Ohio River Valley, that you saw hundreds of Shawnees who moved west of the Mississippi River and sought refuge, sought to a place of security and stability for their families in what was then Spanish territory in the 1780s in what's now what became the Louisiana Purchase and subsequently Arkansas and Kansas and Missouri. And then as Steve mentioned, even for many of those communities that had moved west of the Mississippi prior to 1830, they are relocated once more into what becomes Kansas. And just as importantly, following the Civil War, relocated once again, that I think one of the things we do is we try to encompass removal in this one era and have the Removal Act kind of personify that in a way. And yet, when you look at the history of the Shawnees, they are seemingly in a constant state of removal because of American expansion, especially really from the late 1700s through the 1870s and 80s in many ways.
Where do missions like the one that's been converted into a historic site in Fairway come into this picture that you've just described?
The missionaries are often a part of the story. I mean, missionaries play a fascinating and interwoven role. You know, Steve did a great job in terms of, you know, showing that intertwined relation of Johnson in particular. But you have others. You know, Isaac McCoy, who is a Baptist missionary who first had worked in missions in what's now Indiana and Michigan, and then he becomes a prominent advocate for removal. You know, really believing that removal, you know, from his standpoint, removal was the best hope for Eastern Indian communities to survive. And he advocated removal. He led, you know, removal expeditions, and he sought to create, in many ways, he advocated in the late 1830s the creation of a separate Indian territory in what's now Kansas and Oklahoma. And the missions like the Shawnee Indian mission there in Kansas are, you know, places where, you know, men like Johnson, men like McCoy, you know, still, you know, sought to promote what they saw was both in the best interests of Indians and inevitable in the sense that they needed to change the ways that, in which they lived. And certainly schools, when you know, the idea of targeting children to change the way that the children live to, you know, and that the Shawnee Indian school, this manual labor school, I mean, that's what it was
yeah.
titled.
I mean, history of boarding schools for American Indian children in this country is really controversial. A lot of people look back at these institutions as engines of assimilation, where children were separated from their cultures, their relatives forced to stop speaking their own languages, and yeah, often treated as unpaid labor. What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, I think when you look at the manual labor school, that is very much a part of what it was about, is this notion of changing the ways in which Indians lived, but also very much, you know, teaching Indian children not only how to read and write, but how to work according to the ways in which, you know, kind of the Western notions of work and gender roles of what, you know, boys should be doing, what girls should be doing. And this is a system that you see established at this particular manual labor school when it's founded in 1839. And it's, you know, the similarities between what you see there and even what you see in many of the boarding schools that are in operation in the United States in the 1920s and the 1930s is the same. You know, this emphasis on manual labor.
Steve Warren, how do you reconcile some of what you're hearing? I mean, what's your take on what was going on at the Shawnee Indian Mission in the context of what was going on throughout the nation at the time?
Well, sure. You know, the dramatic change that happens is really from Thomas Jefferson to Andrew Jackson. And Jefferson believed that Native Americans and Euro-Americans would join together and become a shared part of the United States. And in contrast, the Jacksonians, of which Thomas Johnson was a part and Isaac McCoy and these other figures, they were less hopeful and believed that the United States should really be a country in which whiteness meant citizenship. The color of your skin meant that you were a full citizen. And so they promoted a pretty drastic form of ethnic cleansing and removed Native people from areas where they once lived side by side with Euro-Americans. And then they established boarding schools that were designed to destroy their culture. And if you want proof of that, all you have to do is look at a federal program known as the Civilization Fund, of which Thomas Johnson was the primary beneficiary. And so the United States actually paid missionaries to go to what is now Kansas and conduct this work of assimilating Native people into the United States. And so it's a tragic story.
Howard, you volunteer at the historic site that now exists where this school once operated. What are your feelings about this? This is a part of history that's literally in your backyard.
Yes, it is. And my colleagues have done a good job of explaining the mission and its history. We haven't mentioned yet specifically that it was a boarding school for boys and girls. Generally, the ages were 5 to 17 or 18, and they lived on the premises, ate at the premises, particularly when the mission was moved to Fairway, Kansas. It was strictly a boarding school. The boys were taught farming was the major important trade that was taught, but boot and shoemaking, wagon making, building of houses, building of furniture.
Very different skills than they had used in their communities before.
That's right. And the hope was that they could take these back to their tribes and continue to use them, and it would help them assimilate into the white society that was coming. No way to stop it.
Lots to return to when we come back from this break. I'm Gina Kaufman. Central Standard will return in just a minute. Welcome back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's show was inspired by a seemingly simple question. You know Johnson County? Who's Johnson? When we started looking for an answer to that question, we ended up in all kinds of surprising territory. It involves slaveholding, missionary work, the history of the Shawnee Indians in our region, and, it turns out, a murder. So we're going to turn back to our guests today to get more information on the parts of that we haven't heard about yet. We've got Shawnee Indian Mission volunteer Howard Ziegenhorn and historians John Bowes and Stephen Warren. Howard Ziegenhorn, what eventually happened to the Shawnee Indian Mission? When and why did it close?
The mission was closed in 1862 at the beginning of the Civil War. Union troops were quartered at the mission. It was an outpost. And Reverend Johnson had moved, actually, from the mission in 1858, moved to Missouri, 38th and Euclid Avenue, or I'm sorry, Askew Avenue. And he eventually, well, in 1865, he was murdered at his home.
In Jackson County.
In Jackson County, exactly.
So Johnson of Johnson County ended up, before his life ended, moving to Jackson County and about being murdered there. What do we know about that murder? That's terrible.
Well, the murder is controversial, just like his life was. There are two different points of view. One point of view is that he was murdered by bushwhackers, maybe some remnants of Quantrell's group. So because he became a Unionist, was against secession, and it was felt that he was a traitor to the Southern cause. Another point of view is that he had received a large sum of money, $1,000 the day before from a loan that he had made, and it may have been, according to some sources, a bungled burglary attempt.
So what ended up happening to the land where the mission had already closed? What happens to that land when Johnson dies? Does he still own the land at that point?
The land was tributed, that is, he received in the Treaty of 1854, the Missionary Society received three sections of land. So when Reverend Johnson was murdered, it went to his heirs. There were seven children living at that time and his wife. So the land was divided, the 2,000 acres of the mission was divided up among that group. Eventually, it was sold off and to many other people.
So back to the story of Johnson, do we know why they named Johnson County after this guy, Thomas Johnson, who was so controversial, and especially in Kansas, a state that takes so much pride in its free state origins? To have named Johnson County after a slaveholder seems surprising.
Reverend Johnson and his son Alexander, by the way, were both elected to the territorial legislature in an election of 1855. In that election, Reverend Johnson became the president of the council, that is the upper house, and the territorial legislature met at the mission after, by the way, meeting for 5 days or so in Pawnee, Kansas, which is now part of Fort Riley, they moved to the mission.
And this was called, am I right, the bogus legislature?
Yes.
That's the official name of it.
You are exactly right. That may not be the official name of it, but it was considered a bogus legislature because the Missourians did not want a free state next door. So when the election was called, the Missourians came over with their Bowie knives and their revolvers, and they... Well, let's put it this way. Out of 6,303 votes, a committee from Congress established that 4,980 were bogus. That is, that they were illegal. So that's where it got its name. So as they met at the mission, which was the, I would call it the Marriott Mission of Kansas at that time, that is when Reverend Johnson's namesake, Johnson County, began.
Interesting. So I want to turn back to our other historians. John Bowes, before we went to break, we were talking about with Howard about the idea that the skills that the children who were attending this boarding school at the Shawnee Indian Mission, that the skills they were learning might have been important to them with the direction things were turning in this country toward white colonizers' power. What do you think about that? I mean, is that another way of seeing this assimilation process, that these skills were going to be in some way useful to these children?
That's an interesting question, because, I mean, when we talk about the utility of skills that were learned, I mean, in many ways, it's, you know, it's a situation where, when you think about it, the operations of a school like that take quite a bit. Just, you know, the idea of during the wintertime, the wood that is needed to fuel the fires in the mission, you know, the work that needs to be done around the mission just for upkeep and maintenance. Again, this is a sizable operation. And in many ways, the manual labor performed by students is manual labor that is simply to keep the school running. So if the, you know, the idea of what they will be able to do with those skills later on is to help you know, that they'll get, you know, start careers helping or being support staff for mission institutions, you know, that might be the case. I mean, I think, you know, certainly the instruction in reading and writing, you know, the extent to which that is emphasized at points is far more helpful than kind of the skills in terms of manual labor. I think the notion of having a school of you know, manual labor and terming of that is in part built into the larger notions that Indians didn't know how to work. You know, this perspective, this skewed, biased perspective of how Indians needed to be civilized. I mean, I think the operations of the school in terms of that manual labor emphasis is built out of that larger problematic perspective of missionaries and the American public as a whole in many ways.
How did the politics of this region in Kansas and Missouri affect the Shawnee Indians?
Well, I mean, they affected them dramatically. I mean, I think one of the things that's again is interesting about the process and even Johnson in particular is, you know, Howard mentioned how Johnson was elected a territorial delegate in 1855. One of the things that most people aren't aware of is the simple fact that prior to the Kansas-Nebraska Act, you had Wyandotte Shawnees and others who were very aware that the United States had its eyes on this portion of the country, that people were looking to organize it, develop it, expand into it. And you have an attempt in 1852 and then in 1853 as well by Indians and others in the region, by Wyandots, by Shawnees, by Johnson, by you know, other, you know, individuals in the region to organize the territory themselves and in essence to preempt the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And Johnson is elected as the representative of this, what they called Nebraska Territory, and even sent to Congress in 1853, and Congress refuses to seat him. You know,
Remind
refuses.
Us what the Kansas-Nebraska Act is, what it does.
Well, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, as passed in May of 1854, organizes Kansas Territory, which is pretty much the boundaries that we know now as Kansas, a little bit different, and then Nebraska territory, which was essentially everything north of that. And in many ways, the main emphasis for it, or the motivation for it, was to organize this territory so that you could begin to build a railroad, you know, the transcontinental railroad. California has come into a state. People want to figure out how to connect, you know, from the Mississippi River to the Pacific Ocean. And so the organization of Kansas territory is in many ways an effort to get that territory more structured so that railroads could begin building into it. And the fight over slavery, and that crisis and bleeding Kansas becomes such a focus that we often forget that all of that happened, you know, was happening on Indian land. You know, Howard had mentioned the ways in which Johnson obtained title to the sections of land upon which the mission was built, and that's a treaty, you know, signed with the Shawnees in 1854, and it's one of many treaties signed with Indian tribes in that region, because United States officials were requiring land cessions so that they could free up land for railroads to be built through. I mean, one of the things you see in many of those treaties are the names of different railroad companies that are going to be seeking to build their way through Kansas.
Stephen Warren, your dissertation was called Between Villages and Nations, The Emergence of Shawnee Nationalism. That's a really rich title. How does this come down in your mind to a story of villages and nations?
Well, I think that the goal of the United States was to create nations modeled after the United States. And these reservations in Kansas were the place where that was going to happen. Actually, the story that I feel is necessary to tell is one of the failure of that idea. I think that Shawnees largely reject that story by what is today three federally recognized tribes, and one of them is known as the absentee Shawnee tribe of Oklahoma, and the reason why is because they deliberately absented themselves. They refused to go to the reservation in Kansas, preferring instead to live really as squatters, independent of the United States, because they didn't want to deal with places like the Shawnee Mission, the deliberate assimilation of their people. There's a lot of resistance to this movement on the part of the United States that we forget. And these older villages, I think, are really at the core of Shawnee identity.
What about Shawnee nationalism? I mean, when you talk about Shawnee nationalism, how would you describe that phenomenon and what's come of it?
Sure. Well, there are... this is a complicated story, and I'm sure your listeners don't want to deal with it. But the missions become directly involved in a power play between the villages. These villages are associated with kinship groups that go back to the time before colonizers arrived in America. And there's a group of people known as the Mikoche Shawnees, who are a kin group that hasn't traditionally been associated with leadership. And these Mikoche Shawnees become allied with Thomas Johnson and others and attempt to create a nation out of these various villages. And so, they are not successful in that. But I think... if we want to learn more about modern tribes, the 566, federally recognized tribes in the United States, then we should look at Kansas, because that's where they really emerge.
Let's hold that thought. Central Standard's got to take a short break. We'll wrap up this conversation about the Shawnee Indians and the history of Johnson County in just a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we've got just a short time to wrap up today's Central Standard conversation about the Shawnee Indians and Reverend Thomas Johnson, who Johnson County is named for. He ran the Shawnee Indian Mission in what is now Fairway, Kansas. And Professor Stephen Warren, you were just talking about how the rest of the country should be looking at Kansas to understand a lot of the history that's gone on between white people and Native Americans in our country. It is incredible how many place names in our area relate to this history. There are probably people listening right now who drive down Shawnee Mission Parkway in Johnson County several times a day. What is the significance of those place names to you?
Well, they all relate to the previous owners of the land that we now occupy. And so, you know, I wanted to follow up on John's comment and just point out that through the Kansas-Nebraska Act, nine tribes lost 43 million acres, or about 72% of their land. The Shawnees went from 1.6 million acres to 200,000 acres. And the reservation that the Shawnees lived on is now the wealthiest county in all of Kansas. And so this is a tremendous story that we need to remember, because I think it's probably some of the viewers or listeners rather would imagine that that had to occur to make way for progress. But I would just point out that Shawnees actually had already adjusted to the United States and had already made pretty significant changes to their culture in order to live with their non-Indian neighbors.
I've got to jump in here. Howard Ziegenhorn, we got to go in just a second, but what's the short answer to what people will see at that Shawnee Indian Mission today?
We have a museum that is tells the story of the mission, and there are three brick buildings still existing from the original.
Well, Howard Ziegenhorn, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And John Bowes of Eastern Kentucky University, thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Stephen Warren of the University of Iowa, it's been so fascinating. Thank you for your knowledge and information.
Thank you.
As we dig deep into the history of our region, we're stumbling upon all kinds of fascinating stories and characters. KCUR's Suzanne Hogan has the story of a Shawnee spiritual figure who led a resistance movement against white settlers who were taking over tribal land. He was known as the Shawnee Prophet. Here's that story.
My friend Asa Wilder is the one who first told me about the Shawnee prophet, Tenskwatawa. He says he was looking around his room one day, thinking about his relationship to the city, when he came across an old Shawnee Mission East basketball t-shirt.
It just kind of sparked the idea that I'm from Overland Park. I'm from Shawnee Mission. And that's a connection that I've never really thought about or explored.
This exploration led him, and eventually me, down a rabbit hole of research about Shawnee Indians, ending up at this sacred place in the Argentine neighborhood of Kansas City, Kansas. A ravine leads to White Feather Spring.
This ancient spring marks the heart of the last prophet's town of the Shawnee Indians.
Ace is reading the plaque.
The hut of the Shawnee prophet, Tenskwatawa, brother of the great Tecumseh, stood above the spring. He died and was buried here in 1837, a broken and forgotten man.
It's so sad.
Broken and forgotten man.
The plaque sits in front of a white picket fence. The property behind it leads down to the spring. It's privately owned by the Shawnee tribe, but in recent years has been watched over by neighbors, Ernesto and Lupe Arvizu. Tenskwatawa is the name of the prophet. It means open door, which is a fun coincidence, seeing that the Arvizus seem to have a pretty open door policy at their house. They offer to take us down to the spring. The couple are not Shawnee. They're from Mexico, but they both have indigenous roots in Mexico. They say they didn't know they were living next to sacred land when they first bought their house 20 years ago. But Ernesto says it's had an impact on their lives.
We've been having a lot of rough times, and we was to the point where we can lose the house. And some hocus pocus reason, the solution appears, and then we take care of everything.
As if he says they're supposed to be here as guardians. Lupe grabs a homemade walking stick with the prophet's name on it, and Ernesto offers up a Cuban cigar. He cuts it open and puts the tobacco in our hands.
We're going to offer this tobacco And we're going to do it on 4 points, south, north, west, and east.
We sprinkle the tobacco on the ground, asking for permission and protection. But for someone who is said to be a broken and forgotten man in his memorial, it doesn't really feel like that now, in this place, with these people. To find out more about the prophet's story, I talked to historian Adam Jortner on Skype.
I think in more recent years, the prophet has gained back some of the respect and some of the admiration that he had lost over that time as a symbol of someone who said no.
It was the early 1800s in the Old Northwest, an area that now covers Ohio, Illinois, Indiana. Two Shawnee brothers, the war chief Tecumseh and the prophet Tenskwatawa, were at the center of Native American resistance against United States settlers. But Jortner says Tenskwatawa wasn't always seen as a leader.
Right up until about 1804, he was a failure. He had managed to blind himself in one eye, so he couldn't hunt, couldn't fight, couldn't be a soldier. He was a drunk.
One day he's sitting by a fire. He may have been drunk. There's a disease in the village, and he collapses. Some tellings of the story even say that he dies. And it's then that he experiences something profound.
He has a vision from the Master of Life, from God, telling him that he is the one who has been picked to reform Native American life.
Jortner says Tenskwatawa awakes a transformed man. He starts preaching that tribal people shouldn't drink alcohol. He condemns intertribal violence, saying all the tribes should unite together to fight against the United States. He was against Christian missionaries. He gets involved in witch hunts and even condemns some people to death. And as he gains more and more followers, he becomes a bigger pain for Indiana Governor William Henry Harrison, who later became president.
William Henry Harrison is trying to turn Indiana from Native American territory into white territory, and the Shawnee prophet says, no, you can't do it. And there's that religious conflict there. Two differing visions of what it is that God wants in Indiana. William Henry Harrison sends a note, furious note, saying, this man is an imposter. If he is really authorized by God, he will be able to perform miracles. So ask him to perform a miracle.
He says even more specifically, and I quote, ask him to cause the sun to stand still, the moon to alter its course, the rivers cease to flow, or the dead to rise from their graves.
Harrison thinks this is great. You know, this guy doesn't have any real religious power. Ask him to do a miracle. He won't be able to do it. That'll be the end of it.
And then, on June 16th, 1806, there's an eclipse.
The Shawnee prophet puts out the sun. He had promised there would be an eclipse, and then at the middle of the day, there is an eclipse.
Now, there's debate in the history world whether or not Tenskwatawa was tipped off about the eclipse from scientists and almanacs. But regardless, Jortner says the effect is profound. He attracts even more followers and establishes Prophetstown, where his brother, Tecumseh, continues to organize an intertribal Indian confederacy.
Tecumseh gets the credit, but in a lot of ways, he was just an apostle of his brother.
Governor Harrison's troops and Tenskwatawa end up facing off in the bloody Battle of Tippecanoe. Tecumseh is away, leaving the prophet in charge. U.S. history regards this battle as a victory. The losses were comparable on both sides. And it's said that after the battle, the prophet flees, losing power. But historian Adam Jortner thinks that though Tenskwatawa was upset by the battle's result, the prophet remained influential.
He is, and Tecumseh are both aware that this is their moment. And they're sending one message to the Americans. They send these messages, oh, we want to make peace, we're so sorry. When they go to the Canadians, when they go to other tribes, they have a totally different message. They're saying, we are going to strike, and they're building a military coalition to strike back.
This all leads up to the War of 1812, where Tecumseh's Confederacy sides with the British in Canada against the United States. To grossly sum up that whole war, Tecumseh dies in battle, the U.S. wins, and the prophet becomes a refugee, living in Canada. In 1830, the Indian Removal Act is passed, and the U.S. government offers the prophet a deal to return and lead a group of Shawnee to a new reservation in Kansas.
A broken and forgotten man, his dream of an Indian confederacy smashed at Tippecanoe in 1812.
So that's what the plaque means. The prophet had lost. He was defeated. This deal even turns him into a type of removal agent. But perhaps this move is the closest way he can still live his dream. When he arrives in Kansas, he establishes a small prophet's town, but he's mostly ostracized. Eventually, he moves to the area at White Feather Spring, where he spends the last years of his life. The spring still pumps out fresh water today. Ernesto, Lupe, Asa, and I have made our way down the ravine. There are tires, plastic bags, a shopping cart downstream, but where the water trickles out, it's clear. I take a drink.
Wow, yeah, it's really good.
And no joke, a red-tailed hawk flies right overhead while we're down there.
Yeah.
See that? That's a good sign right there.
I'm going to tell you something. I have a lot of faith. First in God, but after that, in my Indian. I say he's mine because I live here now, but he belongs to everyone.
Lupe and Ernesto Arvizu now go to powwows in the area, and they include Tenskwatawa and other American Indian leaders, along with family who have passed away, in their Day of the Dead altar every year. They continue to advocate for people to respect the sacred land, watching over it, and encouraging people not to forget the deep history beneath their feet.
That was KCUR's Suzanne Hogan. And that's a wrap for today's show. Some of it originally aired back in February of 2015. You can listen back to this morning's conversations or any of the stuff you've heard in the past at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, do alt weeklies still matter? Former Pitch editor Scott Wilson certainly thinks so. We'll talk with him and others as the pitch changes hands, plus how to breathe new life into underused parks. That's tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman. That's it for today. Up to date is next.